I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
When someone says slavery, the first thing that comes to your mind might be stories of slavery from America's past, maybe the end of slavery with the Civil War.
But slavery persists today around the globe. A new report from the Walk Free Foundation counts 30 million people as slaves around the world. Here to explain this new global slavery index and to explain how slavery persists today is Kevin Bales, lead author of the Global Slavery Index and author of Disposable People, New Slavery in the Global Economy. And welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of the problem of slavery in the world today, Kevin?
Well, I mean, you said it in one way right a moment ago when you say 30 million people in slavery around the world. It's in every country, certainly every country that we investigated, which was 162 countries, which covers almost the entire global population. It's an interesting paradoxical, though, because 30 million people out of a global population of 7 billion is actually a very small fraction of the global population. And what they generate into the global economy is actually a fairly small part of the global economy. But clearly, you know, any person in slavery is one too many, and 30 million is really far too many.
When we think about slavery today, I'm not sure it might be in America. We think about our history in this country. Probably every country has something different that comes to mind. So how would you describe what slavery looks like around the world in 2013?
Well, it takes about as many forms as have already existed in human history. But the key thing to understand is that slavery is when one person is completely controlled by another person. Violence is used to maintain that control. And the point of that control is that they're going to be exploited economically, sexually, and almost in any way the criminal can think to do so. So it takes different forms. Sometimes it's debt bondage. Sometimes it's a human trafficking. Sometimes it's playing on people's sense of opportunity to offer them jobs which turn out not to be jobs when they get there. So it takes many different forms around the world, but it's always about that complete and violent control.
Well, according to the report, the nations with the most slaves account for more than three-quarters of the slaves around the world. Does that mean that maybe we should focus our energies on these few countries to maximize impact, or does everybody everywhere need to be vigilant and involved here?
Well, I think the answer to that question is yes to both halves of that question, because we certainly need to concentrate on those countries where we have an awful lot of people in slavery. India leads the pack. 14 million of the 30 million, we believe, are in India. And China, Pakistan, Gabon, some of the other northwestern African countries, very large numbers, very large proportions of their population, Haiti as well. But as I said, slavery is found in every single country, certainly in the United States. And it's the thing that's surprising is that the countries that are like the United States, which have very low levels of corruption, good law enforcement, decent laws, a kind of infrastructure of social services, and that should mean that it would be impossible to have slavery. And in some ways, while India may have some excuses, you have to ask about Western European countries or the United States, you know, what on earth are they doing with having any slaves at all?
Well, I have to follow up on that. You said India has some excuses. Are we talking about the caste system?
Well, there are a lot of cultural factors within India, and I don't actually think there's an excuse for slavery. But there are reasons why we know that slavery will blossom up. One is conflict. Sometimes it's about those extreme forms of discrimination, like the caste system. High levels of governmental corruption, which you also find in parts of India, tends to create a sense of law, a situation of lawlessness. And when that rule of law doesn't work, then people are not protected against people who would make slaves of them. So you'll find those sorts of factors creating situations where people can be enslaved, more in India and more in many of the other even poorer countries. But you know, all countries really have no excuse. They've all passed laws against slavery, and they've all signed the international conventions that ban it.
Now, the backstory on this report is pretty interesting, as I understand it. This is supposed to be one of the most comprehensive global surveys of slavery ever done. And apparently the man behind it is an Australian millionaire or billionaire. Can you talk about the back a little bit here?
Well, I can. I mean, yes, Andrew Forrest and his wife Nicola are the primary philanthropists that are supporting the Walk Free Foundation. He's a mining executive. He's been digging iron ore in Western Australia for quite some time and has made billions out of that. And has now come to a point in his life where he's wanting to pay it back and do good things with what he's earned, and has decided to give an enormous shot in the arm to the global anti-slavery movement, which has been operating on pretty much a shoestring, in spite of the fact that the numbers are what they are. So he's enabled us to do what's never been done before, and that's really go in depth, not just in the estimation of how many people are in slavery, but to spend a lot of time thinking carefully and doing a lot of research in what are the causes of slavery in each different country, so which leads us to then what are the right points of intervention in each country.
It's an interesting point about, you know, how an influential person becomes involved in a particular cause. Now, in his case, I read that his daughter volunteered in an orphanage, I think it was in Nepal or India.
In Nepal.
And was working with children who were sex trafficked, and that kind of personal connection brought someone in. And is it possible that this one man can do what he says? He's trying to stamp out global slavery, with help, of course.
Well, there's a number of us who have been aiming at eradicating slavery on the planet Earth for some time, but certainly when you bring a bigger stick to the game, you can move things along rather faster, to mix up the metaphors pretty terribly there. But yes, you know, resources have always been a question within the global anti-slavery movement. We know how to get people out of slavery. We know how much it will cost to do so. But it's always been a question of scaling that up. The resources have never met the level of demand.
Now, how do you get people out of slavery when it sounds like in some cases you're talking about a societal problem that's pretty entrenched?
Well, there are several different ways, and it does depend on which type of slavery and entrenched in what way. But let's go back to India for a moment. One of the most common types of slavery there is something called hereditary collateral debt bondage. In other words, a family borrows money. That's just the excuse, really, the mechanism. But the collateral part is that, unlike the loan that you or I might take out for a house or a car, they have to put up themselves as the collateral for the loan. Not just themselves, their bodies, but all the work that they do is held by the collateral, held by the slaveholder as collateral until the loan is repaid.
And this is illegal, I take it.
No. Yeah, oh, yes, it's certainly illegal. That's right. It's certainly illegal.
But it happens, you know, underground.
And people in the countryside, often illiterate, are convinced by those with money and power that this is legal. Mm. So there's trickery going on here as well. And as you can see, since, you know, the slaveholder owns not just the body and soul, as it were, but also the work and the output of the person enslaved, they can never repay that debt. And the debt and the slavery that goes with it passes down through the generations. And I've met many people, many families who have been enslaved in that way in their fourth and fifth generation of slavery in northern India. But the way you address that is that's very effective and very powerful is through community organizing. I mean, very much like Fannie Lou Hamer in the civil rights movement down in the Mississippi Delta. You go into the communities very quietly, you begin the discussions, you introduce the ideas of freedom, you have ex-slaves talking to them about this is the way I used to live, but now I live in a new way, and that fires their curiosity. And in time, they link themselves together and make that stand against their slaveholder that achieves freedom. And normally those communities reach a point very quickly of not just being slave-free, but being slave-proof.
So it requires a lot of people. It sounds like a community effort. It can't just be one person standing up. It needs to be a lot of people standing up together.
That's exactly right. If there's one or two people that you point to, it's those outside, I guess we could call them the outside anti-slavery agitators, right, who come in and help that community to achieve that consciousness of their own potential freedom.
Well, when we come back, I want to know if you could tell us one or two stories about the people you've come across. Sounds like you've met a lot of different people who have gone through this. You mentioned meeting people who were generations of slaves in this way, and also the people who have come out the other side of it and what their lives are like now. It sounds fascinating, so we'll be talking about that in just a moment. Right now, we're talking with Kevin Bales. He is lead author of the Global Slavery Index and professor of contemporary slavery at the Wilberforce Institute for the Study of Slavery and Emancipation at the University of Hull.
And we're wondering if you have any questions about this study or about slavery in the modern world, or maybe in your travels you've encountered something like this. You can contact us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email your thoughts and your questions, talk@WPR.org. We're going to pick up this conversation in just a few minutes after we check in with the news from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, why do we live longer than we used to? Our guest tries to sort out what's keeping us alive.
First, we continue our conversation about modern-day slavery. We're talking with Kevin Bales now, lead author of the Global Slavery Index, talking about a new survey showing that 30 million people worldwide are in slavery. Kevin is a professor of contemporary slavery at the Wilberforce Institute for the Study of Slavery and Emancipation and author of Disposable People. And Kevin, before we went to the news, we were talking about maybe hearing some stories of these people. It sounds like you've met quite a few of them. And I wonder if you could just put a face on this for us, introduce us to some of the people who are going through this and maybe some people who've come out the other side.
Sure. You know, before we went to the news, we were talking a little bit about that hereditary debt bondage slavery in India. And I hold in my mind a wonderful young man named Ramphal, who was born into slavery. He had married and then had children, but of course they were also born into slavery. By the time an anti-slavery worker who was an ex-slave went to his village and began to organize in that village, Ramphal, you know, worked with the other people in that village, saw the opportunity of freedom after they had learned that it was possible and that things could happen, and in time joined with everyone else to stand up against their slaveholder, who had enslaved almost an entire village and had them all working in a big rock quarry. One of the things that I found so wonderful about Ramphal was just after he came out and I met him of slavery, I was saying to him, you know, what do you want to do now? You know, we're gonna make sure that you have resources that you can train yourself, do what you want to do. And he said, oh, I've got this big dream, but it's so big I don't want to talk about it. And I thought, oh, he wants to open a shop or, you know, maybe have his own farm. I was back a couple of years later, and I discovered that Ramphal had become a sort of traveling theatrical producer. It was like Broadway in Bollywood. And he had organized a theater troupe to go around during the Indian wedding season and put on big musical performances about both happiness and weddings, but also about people coming out of slavery and triumphing over bondage. And I realized, you know, inside every person in slavery, I don't know that there's necessarily a Broadway producer, but there's something really wonderful. There's somebody really creative, really interesting, who's been suppressed by slavery.
Gosh, that's a beautiful story. I mean, you wouldn't know what to expect, but I sort of thought that the people who were coming out of slavery, it might have been so ingrained in them, maybe a sense that they didn't have free will, that maybe that they were worthless, that they wouldn't have something like that in them.
Oh, you know, people in slavery know where they are, and they also can look at the people who are even just controlling them and understand that life could be very different for them. It's a bit like when you read the WPA slave narratives from our own country, from, you know, before 1865. And it's very clear that people who were enslaved in the United States and are able to talk about it later, they always understood that they were missing out on a great deal of life, and they kind of knew it from the get-go.
Now, we haven't talked about one aspect, which is, you know, one of the most horrifying, and that is children in slavery. Tell us a little bit about what that problem is like as you see it in the world today. Is it mainly adults, or is there, you know, a pretty large proportion here that is children?
You know, we don't have precise breakdowns in terms of men, women, and children. My best understanding is that in many ways the enslaved population mirrors the general population. So there are men and women and children and families. If there's a difference, it's primarily because slaveholders, criminals, aren't really interested in the elderly. They're not interested in the infirm, and they're usually not interested in infants because they're not productive. But they're certainly interested in children because children are malleable. You know, it's easier to take control of a child. You can start getting significant amounts of labor, very primitive and simple labor, but significant amounts of labor from a child from the time they're 3, 4, 5 years old. So around the world, I have to say, we see all types of child slavery, including child soldiers, children enslaved in pretty horrific types of sexual exploitation, as domestic servants, and as well in many countries. And, of course, in any of those situations, they can also likely be sexually abused.
Now, you talked about how you don't have precise numbers, and of course you wouldn't, but it makes me wonder how you got the numbers that you did this way. How did you get this 3 million estimate?
30 million.
30 million, excuse me.
That's all right. It's a triangulated kind of data process because we're using secondary source information. We're using which comes from all different governments and law enforcement and so forth. We're talking to experts and people who are working on the ground, like the anti-slavery workers I mentioned earlier. But now, and the reason we're feeling much more confident, or at least a little confident, more confident about these numbers, is that we have some random sample survey information for a number of countries where we've been able to actually find out pretty reliably the proportion of a national population that's actually been caught up in slavery or caught up in human trafficking. Now, that's something of a breakthrough. And while we really could have waited another year or two or five to have perfect numbers, we felt, you know, this is like an epidemic. You don't wait till you've got the best number. You start putting out indications of the problem immediately because they need attention.
Now, this report was intended to shine a light on this problem and expose it. And I can't imagine anyone would listen now or read it and not want to know what they could do. So what can people do, both, you know, individually and, you know, at higher levels?
Well, certainly individually, just becoming aware of the problem is crucially important. You know, we really can't solve any problems we don't understand. And it's down to us as citizens, not just of our own country, but of the world, to understand what slavery would look like, say, in the United States or in Wisconsin, but also in the world around us. Now, as I mentioned, as we said before the news, you know, this has always been a resource question. But it's also really a government problem because governments have passed laws against slavery. All governments have passed laws against slavery. And when they do that, they promise their populations, their citizens, that they're not going to have slavery. But around the world, what we see is that while the laws are on the books, almost no enforcement is taking place. Very, very little resources are devoted to it. In the United States, the $200 million or so that is spent on anti-slavery and anti-human trafficking efforts equals about 1 or 2 hours of the war on drugs in terms of expenditure. So, you know, slavery on one side, drugs on another. But one is a minute fraction of the resources given to the other.
So you're saying there need to be more resources directed at solving the problem and awareness. So you gave the example, what does slavery look like in Wisconsin? What does slavery look like in Wisconsin? Do you know? I mean, what kinds of things should people look out for?
Well, I haven't spent a lot of time in Wisconsin, and not lately, but I can tell you that having worked a lot in the United States, that slavery in the United States, you know, has several patterns. You know, there's slavery of people in commercial sexual exploitation, but also in agricultural work and also in domestic service is very common. And then in service-type jobs, say in the backs of restaurants and sometimes cleaning in hotels and so forth. And I have to say also many other types because criminals are very clever. Sometimes hair braiding salons and nail salons have lately had more people. What do people in slavery look like in the United States? They look like that person who seems cowed, frightened, possibly injured, might have signs of brutality. They seem uncertain. They're frightened because they've been told that if they talk to anyone, they'll be harmed by their slaveholder. They're told stories that police will assault them and probably kill them. The slaveholders often threaten families back in their country of origin. And they're often people who don't even know where they are, literally geographically. So they may know they're in a neighborhood or being held in a home, but they won't know what city they're in, and they certainly are unlikely as well to speak the language. It's the tricky thing here is that for Americans, it's often the person that we've sort of in our culture learned to look away from, the person who looks very poor, who looks a bit damaged, who doesn't necessarily look like one of our ethnicity, and we think this is not someone that I'm necessarily supposed to interact with. But they're, in fact, possibly the person most in need of that interaction.
And, Kevin, in our last minute or so, how hopeful are you that your report can accomplish its goal and that we can move quickly toward eradicating global slavery?
Well, I'm very hopeful. I'm very optimistic. And when we say move quickly to eradication, you know, I think in historical terms, and I'm thinking 20, 25, 30 years toward eradication. But, you know, I said this at the top of our interview, that 30 million is a tiny fraction of the global population, and what they produce economically is a minute part of the global economy. And it's against the law in every country. Every religion is against it. It doesn't hold up any industries. The truth is slavery is perched on the edge of its own extinction. And if we make a united push, it'll go over and we won't have it anymore.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this today. Appreciate it.
Oh, I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
We've been talking to Kevin Bales, lead author of the Global Slavery Index. He is the author of Disposable People and a professor of contemporary slavery at the Wilberforce Institute for the Study of Slavery and Emancipation.
Coming up next, we'll talk about why we're living longer now than ever before. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.